This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have one sponsor for the show, that's our good friends at Jam Software, and we'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. Bradley, how's your week been?
Busy, preparing to wake up early tomorrow to hopefully order a phone. By the time everybody listens to this, that will have either happened or not happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Yes, the internet might be a little slow tomorrow.
Well, the issue I'm running into for my and my wife's phone, so like my wife has AT&T and I'm moving her to Verizon, but Apple generally doesn't sell unlocked phones like on day one. And it turns out if you buy a phone that's like, if you go in there and say, like, there are two iPhones this year, there's one, which I don't understand, like the one that's for AT&T and T-Mobile will not work on Verizon and Sprint, which are CDMA. But if you buy the CDMA phone, it will work on GSM. Makes zero sense to me. I'm sure it's something to do with the bands that the GSM only phone supports.
Okay.
But so
they've got different SKUs now for that. I hadn't really got into that.
Yeah, there's two different SKUs. And so if they were just selling unlocked phones, I'd be fine. So I think what I'm going to do is go through Verizon's website and port her number through their CMS, like pre-order it and port and have her number set to port. And hopefully that doesn't screw up badly. And then since I'm on T-Mobile, I think I'm just going to buy mine unlocked from Apple through T-Mobile, I think.
Okay. So big upgrade in the Chambers household.
Yes. So selling.
Are you going 6 Plus or 6, or 7 Plus, I should say?
I am getting 7 Plus matte black, 128.
Okay. And your wife?
Plus. 7 Plus rose gold. She does not want a big phone, but the better camera interests her. So here's to increasing average selling price for Apple.
Yeah, that's going to sell to a lot of parents. I know that. Indoor photographs at high speed. that's the children's camera, isn't it?
Yeah, and I just wonder, like in day-to-day, how much will the new Zoom feature be used? But all you have to say is better camera and people are buying it. Because that's the people. I mean, honestly, that's the reason most people buy the new phones every year is to have the better camera.
Yeah. I mean, I think the same thing. I watched the show last night, and I thought, I was kind of like, oh, this is okay. And then they showed like the Zoom camera with some level of optical zoom, and I was like, I'm sold, right? That's what I'm going to do. So I'm currently just trying to figure out what I'm going to do and how I'm going to get it and so on. But they've just launched the iPhone upgrade program in the UK. Which was in the US for the last couple of generations, that's now available in, I think, UK and Australia. So I'm looking at that. The other thing with the kind of change in the value of the pound is that the iPhone has gotten quite a lot more expensive in the UK. It's gone from the unlocked mid-tier plus phone, right? The what was a 64 gig 6S Plus and is now 128 gig 7 Plus. That's gone from $699 in the UK to $819, I think it is. So it's jumped about £120 over the course of this time. Which I mean, you can sort of look at that and say, well, okay, you know, the pound slid against the dollar, so that's probably what's going to happen. But, you know, I'm just looking at that going, that's laptop money now. Do you know what I mean? You can't even kid on anymore that's not, it's not Apple laptop money, don't get me wrong, but... You know, you're kind of going, every 2 years am I going to buy a laptop? No, but every 2 years I'm going to buy a phone. So I'm kind of like, I really want to do it, but I'm also sort of wincing a little bit at the price. So I need to see if I can figure a way around that.
My issue with the iPhone upgrade program, because I know at least here in the US, it's zero interest. So it basically works out like the exact same amount per month. My issue with it is not this year, it's next year, because I don't live very close to an Apple store. It's like 2 hours away from me is the nearest one. And so what we're finding out, so like when this thing launched in the US, at first it was retail only. And now you can do it online. But if you did it online last year, or like, I mean, if you like signed up day one on the upgrade program, you have to go into the store to get your new phone. Like there's no way to do that online, I'm assuming, yet. And that must be somehow, because you have to surrender your current phone. And that is fine if you, again, live close to an Apple store, but I don't. And so, like, I could do that this year, and then next year we have to drive to Atlanta is, like, the nearest one. So, like, it's like, do I just suck it up and pay it up for outright today, like, you know, day one, and because it's working out to be the same price. So to save myself from the hassle of having to sell a phone later, because that's how I do this. Like, I buy the new phone every year and then just sell it. And you generally sell it for about half the cost that you paid last year. So I really end up paying about $500 a year for a new phone.
Yeah.
Roughly. Yeah. $450.
Somebody on Twitter, one of the analysts on Twitter was saying, you know, essentially an iPhone is $1 a day, right?
Yeah.
Over the course of its useful life, you know. So, yeah. So you're saying matte black, right? I know there are so many blacks to choose from now. You've got matte black and you've got this, they're calling it jet black, or some people were describing it as a kind of piano black, like a sort of glossy black finish. But you're going matte black.
Yeah, I'm going to put a case on it anyways. I actually already ordered a case from Amazon for like $3.
Okay. Yeah, I would be slightly tempted by the jet black if in the hand it was not as slippery, because I would really like to not have a case on my phone. I don't like, you know, buying the world's most beautiful iPhone and then putting a big case on it. And I've never found a case that I really liked, apart from maybe the Apple leather one. But this sort of glossy jet black finish in a couple of reviews that I read had been described as being grippier than the other finishes. So I'm thinking, oh, that could be quite interesting, you know, instead of just having a super slippery one.
Yeah, the storage sizes are interesting to me. And it's worth noting that the iPad line has some new storage sizes as well. Everything's starting at 32 gig now, except for the iPhone SE, which is still at 16 gig.
Yeah, and you know why that is, right? That's, you know, BlackBerry replacement territory for companies.
Yeah, that's a company, like, we're deploying 100 iPhones at once. So it is, I wouldn't say kudos to Apple for finally doing this, because it should have been done like 2 to 3 years ago. But it is great that like 32 gigs is finally the norm. I'm using about 20 gigs on my phone. How, I don't really know. I have everything in Google Photos and I stream all my music from Apple Music, but I think it's just like caching. But I think, you know, I'm going to 128 just because, like, for $100 more, you're getting like, you know, 96 more gigabytes. I mean, that is a lot. The 256 gig, like, I don't even know who needs that, to be honest with you. Like, I don't. I mean, I know some people will buy it because they love to have all their media downloaded locally. Like, I get that. But that's, like, that's just a lot.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, you know, if you're turning your phone over every 2 years, like, what's happening over the next 2 years that you need 256 gigs? I mean, I don't deny, and I imagine this is true, that there are certainly people in the world who, for whom a 128 gig phone is not big enough. But the main application I can even think of that would be true is either people who want like 100 games on their phone at the same time, or people who shoot a lot of video and don't have the opportunity to offload that in the field. So if you were like really into iPhone video and you took like a 2 week trip somewhere and you're shooting video all the time and you're away from home and you can't get it downloaded or whatever, I mean, how many people is that true for? I don't know, but you know, maybe there's something coming. I don't know.
I mean, I think there's a subset of people that just want the Mac storage they can buy, and that was that the money is irrelevant.
They just never want to see that dialogue that says your storage is almost
full. I would be fine with a 64 gig.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I've got had a 64 gig for 2 years. In fact, 4 years, because my previous one was 64 gigs as well. And I think for me, since the advent of iCloud Photo Library, where every night when I get onto Wi-Fi, all my photos are backed up to the cloud and optimized off the phone, and that has worked really well for me since the day it launched. I've never seen the storage dialogue. Now, what I do see from time to time is a lot of photos getting optimized away quite quickly. So maybe it's just that you would get a better experience in the Photos app as well. I'm not sure.
One of the things, I guess, we're not going to talk about everything from the keynote because most of our listeners probably have read about it, but we're going to kind of hit the highlights of things we think are, we might provide an interesting analysis for that our listeners might particularly care about. AirPods are very interesting to me. Like, I saw those on the keynote and I thought, these look terrible, I'll never buy these. And then I kept reading reports from people that had used them, and my tune was changing. I think they stay in pretty well. But they are small. I would run with them at all. The charging system is very interesting, how it has like a 5 hour battery life, but then the case charges them for, you get up to 24 hours total. And then you can actually charge the case then. So it's kind of like how Kindle's case charges the Kindle. Like, if anybody's.
Yeah, there's a battery in the case and you can charge them as one. So there's a lightning port in the bottom of the case and you put the buds in the case and then you charge both together. But basically, every time, the thing I think is cool about that is every time you kind of put them away during the day, they get charged up a bit again. So you're never really going to pull them out and they're dead unless you've completely depleted the case battery as well, which I think is probably not super likely.
They are definitely expensive, but I'll tell you.
They're expensive.
Yeah, $159. Yeah. But I'll tell you, the thing that is interesting to me overall with this is the technology is the W1 chip. Mm-hmm. Bluetooth audio is great when you have one device. But like, for example, yeah. One of the things I always loved about the Rokus is the built-in headphone jack. Well, the Apple TV supports Bluetooth headphones, but then like they're paired with my, you know, my like my Power Beats are paired with my phone, so I have to like turn off Bluetooth on my phone, put my headphones in pairing mode, pair them with the Apple TV, you know, and you go through that whole song and dance. I mean, that's a mm-hmm. pain, and yeah. It looks like it syncs over iCloud, like your current yeah. devices, and so that's yeah. that is like absolutely fantastic. That's a fantastic so, technology, yeah. And it, obviously, it's some proprietary Apple sauce, but and this is a place where like the seamless integration of hardware and software beats open standards.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really nice to experience that. They talked in the keynote about it being able to auto switch between devices that are playing, but what that is it basically it can auto switch between your watch and your phone. But say you wanted to then use them on your iPad, you'd have to pick them as a sound output on your iPad or on your Mac. So it's not completely zero intervention to get it to switch. But have you ever seen the movie Her?
No.
The one, it's great, great movie. But the story is basically a futuristic world where your artificial assistant kind of lives in your ear, like Siri lives in your ear. And the story is about a man who falls in love with his AI assistant, right? But ever since I saw that movie, I've been like, I just want something in my ear that will sort of feed me information all the time. And this is kind of maybe a step closer to that, I think. There's a lot of smart stuff to do with that. So, for example, you get two independent buds, right? They're not wired at the back like some Bluetooth headsets are. But it can tell when you've only got one in your ear. So you can work it with just one. So if you want a Siri phone call device, you can actually just put one in if you want. You don't have to put both in. But this was the point at which I knew I was going to buy these things was when somebody reported that if you take them out your ears, your music pauses on your phone. I was like, that is sold. I'm done. Right, I'm going to get those. And I actually might want those more than a new phone. Right? I'm thinking I'm going to get them as soon as they're out, but the phone I can wait for a little bit. So,
well, you can see the future of that is when they can get the battery, like, say, had an 8 to 9 hour battery. You just yeah. wear those all day, and you have Siri proactively reaching out to you. Like, yes. Hey, Bradley, you need to leave your next appointment. Traffic's a little heavy.
Yeah.
Hey, Bradley, you got a text from your wife. You need to look, you know, you can see where it's almost the reverse of the watch, where the watch is quick notifications you can read. The AirPods would be quick notifications in your ear.
So there's no visual interaction with any physical object at all.
Yeah, and so same thing with Siri now is like you're proactively talking to Siri, like, hey Siri, can you do this? Hey Siri, what about this? And this would be the reverse where it's like, hey Bradley, traffic's heavy, you need to leave, or hey Bradley, you have the new calendar invite. Hey Bradley, new email from a VIP here from your wife. So I probably will buy those. I wasn't considering it at the time, but now that I've read some more and thought about it, I think I could. I think this is, you know, these are not just Bluetooth headphones. These are a lot. I think this is step one of a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, they remind me a little bit of the Touch ID sensor in the sense that the Touch ID sensor came out and then a year later Apple Pay came out and everybody was positioned with, you know, cryptographically secure biometric identifiers on their phones and things like that. And suddenly the other shoe drops. And I kind of see AirPods a little bit the same way that, okay, you can listen to your music and you can invoke Siri by double tapping either bud and things like that. But I can see like iOS 11, if you've got AirPods, look what Siri can do for you now. And I think there's some very interesting potential there.
Yeah, absolutely. Next thing is a new program called Apple Teacher. And this is, mm-hmm. This is interesting here.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we go into that, I forgot to tell you that our school name was on that slide with all the schools on it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. That was in the context of schools that have adopted Swift Playgrounds. Now, past tense is a little optimistic because iOS 10 hasn't shipped yet, but we we've been talking to the team behind Swift Playgrounds and so on since I was at WWDC, and we are definitely going to, actually after the October holidays this year, I'm going to start teaching the first class with Swift Playgrounds. And that was the context of that slide, was here are all these schools that are adopting Swift Playgrounds. So I was quickly scanning it to see if I could see my name, but or our school's name, but it wasn't there. Or I couldn't see it because it was so small and so fast. But somebody sent me a screenshot later and they'd highlighted their school, and then just beside their school was our school. So finally made it onto a keynote slide. What can I say?
That's awesome. That's the first.
That's the first, yeah. I have not been on a live keynote slide before. So, sorry, that was me getting carried away there. Apple Teacher, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have Apple Teacher, but then we also have the Apple Distinguished Educator. And so you've had a pretty good analysis on Twitter of what you think the differences between these two are.
Yeah. So the Apple Distinguished Educator program has always been, and I've used the phrase beauty contest, and I don't mean that in any kind of pejorative sense, but it's the way you get to become an Apple Distinguished Educator is that you submit the kind of work you've done to Apple, and they decide whether or not they like it enough to make you an Apple Distinguished Educator, right? There's no exact, clearly defined threshold that you can meet after which you definitely become an Apple Distinguished Educator, right? It's a wee bit more like getting into a nightclub, you know, where if the bouncer likes the look of you, you'll get in. So what... By contrast, right, the Google Certified Teacher program has always been a bit more knowledge-based, where to become a Google Certified Teacher, what you do is you sit a number of online tests and demonstrate your, to be fair, a fairly basic level of knowledge about Google products like Google Apps for Education and Google Docs and Forms and so on, and then you become a Google Certified Teacher. Apple has never really had a program like that, and I think that Apple Teacher is what that program is. Now, after we finish recording tonight, Bradley, about 11 o'clock my time, there's a webcast, which I'm going to try and join. And what I think I'll do, if this is okay with you, is I'll maybe record a wee extra bit for the end of the show, once I know a little bit more about it, and we'll try and give people a little more information that way too.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Next thing is iWork updates. And this felt awkward to me, in terms of like when they announced this and they were talking about it, I was thinking, what are they going to say? And then they said real-time collaboration, and that's great. And my joke was, I guess iWork.com finally came out of beta. I think that launched in like 2008.
Yeah, it's been there a while. Yeah.
And and it's fine, but I just – it just feels like in some ways like finally. And I'm also not convinced that it will work as good as Google does on collaboration.
Yeah, I think we've all become used to a very high standard of performance and reliability in that field. And if they don't meet that, and that is a very high bar, because, I mean, the software, hardware, internet, server-side components of all of that are not simple software to write. So, you know, kudos to Google for having had it so good for so long. But what I'm slightly concerned about from a school point of view is that we'll have this ability, but... This is at the document level, right? So you can, as far as I can tell, you can kind of invite people into your documents and they can work together with you. But there's no underlying collaboration model at the storage layer. So if you know what I mean, if you think about Google Drive, right? Google Docs stored in Google Drive, you can share a folder, you can work with those document formats and others collaboratively at the drive level, but then you can also collaborate live in the document. And I kind of feel like you've got to have both parts of that system to have a fully rounded working system. I mean, what you're going to have here with iWork, I think, is it's going to be much more sort of, I'm working on a keynote. Would you, like on a Skype call, jump into the document with me and help me with this one slide? Which is exactly what they demoed on the stage, was somebody, you know, making an edit to one slide that, in a slide deck that ostensibly somebody else owned. So to me, it's kind of, I mean, it's great that they've done it. It will be very interesting to see how well it works and how reliable it is, particularly in a school situation where the network traffic is heavy. But I think we still need to see much more collaboration capabilities at the iCloud Drive level as well in order to kind of be a real serious competitor to Google.
Yeah, because there's no way to like create shared folders in iCloud Drive and things like that. And I mean, the number of times, for me, when it comes to like document editing and collaboration – the times that simultaneously is like 3% of the time.
Yeah.
It's often like, hey, I worked on this document, so what you think?
Yes. And I mean, that's how we work for the notes in the show, for example.
Yeah. And so I don't, you know, then, you know, my fear is that it's just going to be, it's going to work pretty good, but it's not going to be perfect. That's my fear. And partly too, you think about Google's design, it's web only. Mm-hmm. And so there's no local applications on like the desktop, for example. And so I'm worried about like, say, Pages on the Mac. How is it going to be? Is it, I don't know, like, is it going to be constantly just spewing updates up, or is it going to sync every 5 seconds, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be more than that. I mean, if they're talking about live, real-time collaboration, it's got to be like two cursors in the document jumping about at the same time.
Right.
So I think it's going to be ad hoc work, you know. But the thing about, you know, if you think about the way that we work with our show notes, right, is that we have a shared Google Drive folder, and every week we make a new document in that folder, and because it's in that folder, that's when we get it. Whereas if we were to switch to Pages with this kind of collaboration, for example, we would have to essentially set up the collaboration over and over again every single week with a new document.
Right. Well, and another thing too is a lot of schools are already using Google Apps. If you're already using Google Apps, it makes sense to use Google Drive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's
and
that
particularly
whole,
when iCloud Drive is only 5 gigs.
Right. And we still, and there's still no, it's like that'll be our new finally, I guess.
That's going to be the biggest finally ever.
So
now that Google Docs does split view, right? What's the next finally? It's 5 gigs for iCloud.
Right. Finally. We'll see how that shakes out. But
I don't want to talk it down too much, right? Because I'm thinking, I mean, maybe they have just, I mean, there haven't really been updates to iWork in quite a long time, and they've got a lot of smart people working on that software. So what have they all been doing? And you know, they may have cracked it, right? Let's wait and see.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I guess it's exciting, and I hope it works great. But so next thing, and this was not mentioned at the keynote, but and we just kind of alluded to it earlier, iPad storage and price changes all across the line. So both Pro sizes, the 128 gig is down $50. The 256 is down $100. So that's pretty nice.
Yeah, nice price drop. I think because we signed our lease before the Brexit price slide on Sterling hit, we would probably end up paying about the same amount of money for our devices after all.
Air 2 Mini 4 are now 32 and 128, and the Mini 2 remains 32 only. So the particularly interesting there for shared iPad. You know, 32, I don't think I'd want to roll out shared iPad on 32. I think I'd want to do it on 128.
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends exactly how many devices you're getting. I mean, if you're getting one iPad between two, I think 32 probably would be okay. But even one between 4 and 32, I'm sort of like, maybe
tight.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. So it's quite good that they're starting to get those kind of out of the channel.
Yeah.
If you can afford a 128 or two, you're in good shape for shared iPad.
Watch stuff, you know, we won't really cover that, but that's some exciting stuff. I think the really interesting thing there is the Series 1. If you don't need GPS or waterproofing, buy the Series 1.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, I mean, actually upgrade to a Series 1 rather than a Series 2. I mean, for me, like, the Series 2 is a little just too focused on health and fitness. You know, I kind of was hoping for some other feature. I mean, maybe the GPS feature will be useful in some way, but again, GPS on the watch is really for like going running without your phone with you, right? If I've got my phone with me, which I always do because I'm not really a runner, do I get any benefit from that?
Yeah, because the watch uses the GPS, the phone's GPS.
Yeah, yeah.
So, when there's, you know, the current lineup, the way it works now. So I mean, that's true. And I'm the type too that when I run, even if I had an Apple Watch, I'm probably going to have my phone with me as well. Mm-hmm. Just for emergencies. So, but no, overall, fun day. Always a fun day, and new phones hopefully soon for me and you.
Mm-hmm. Here's hoping.
Okay, before we move on, let's thank our sponsor for the night, the great folks at Jamf Software. As you guys in your school prepare for iOS 10, no better partner to roll that out with than the folks at Jamf. One of the cool things is now you can now push and force upgrades to iOS devices en masse. you have two options really when you're doing an iPad deployment today. You can do it through an MDM or you can do it through Apple Configurator. I highly recommend looking at MDM. Yes, it does cost money to do that. Apple Configurator is free where MDMs are not. But I promise you, even for deployments of 50 devices, you will see a huge increase in productivity and it's so much easier to push out apps having an MDM. So check out Jamf Software at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com and learn more about their platform for managing Apple products. Also want to thank tonight our Patreons for the month. So we have a Patreon account. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. You have two options to support us, two levels, I guess, $10 a month or more. We give you a mention on the show. And if you do $3 a month, we have you listed on outofschool.net and the Dean's List. But I want to thank Envision Design LLC, Michael Slade and Nicholas Cole Farrell for sponsoring us at $10 or more a month. So go to outofschool.net and look at the show notes to see more about Patreon, how you can support the show and just to say thanks for us, doing this, I guess, is a simple way to say it.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you notice, I don't know if you saw that Jamf Software just released their iOS 10 release of Casper, I think, yesterday?
Yes, I got the email. Mine's being upgraded on Saturday.
Nice, nice. I upgraded yesterday as well. And some kind of interesting features in there, just worth mentioning. One is you can now, if you have a smart group of devices, they've got a new tab for smart groups called Automated Management. Now, the only thing you can do right now is you can set the wallpaper of the device, but this is a trick that I used last week for the kind of people who had steadfastly refused to update iOS. What I did was for that group, I just found that group and I gave a command to the group manually which said set their wallpaper, and I had this wallpaper that just said please update to iOS 9.35 or your iPad will get locked, and that convinced a few more people to do so. But nowadays, if a device falls into a smart group based on some criteria, it will actually just get its wallpaper set automatically. So now I can set up my smart group for people who have not updated. I can just put that wallpaper in there and that will be automatically shown to them whenever I change the criteria to require the next version of iOS.
Oh, yeah. So that's it's always good to see these managed platforms. They continually get better and better. Yeah.
Oh, and the other thing is that in that version of GSS, that now has the configuration profile setting to control whether or not the students can turn on Bluetooth on or off. And that's important for Apple Classroom, because iOS 10 brings this new restriction where you're not allowed to make changes to the Bluetooth setting. So now what you can do is you can send that profile and the kids can't turn off Bluetooth to hide from Apple Classroom.
Haha. Yeah, we discussed that earlier in the summer as well. So that's good to see that. Yeah. Short-lived problem if you're having that.
Yes.
Okay, so another thing we want to talk about tonight was a request from a listener to talk about some preschool apps. Like, what do we, you know, both, like, you know, for younger than kindergarten, what are some good apps? And before we talk about some apps that we like, I thought it would be helpful to, like, identify some criteria that are just good things to look for specifically for preschool apps. First one is updated often, and this may change, like not have to need this as much because Apple is kind of wiping the store of broken apps, but still it's helpful to, like, I wouldn't, like, if you go look at an app and it hasn't been updated since like 2014, I don't know, might consider something else.
We've got a problem with that right now in school where teachers are in love with this particular app called Moodboard, which hasn't been updated since 2012.
Ooh.
And every year I'm like, maybe just use Keynote for this feature, because all it does is let you put, you know, pictures and text on it on a background. And they're like, oh, Keynote's too complicated. Well, you know, we're talking about like for 6 and 7 year olds. And I'm like, but guys, that's going to break one day and you're going to lose all your data. So,
have you contacted the developer?
I have not, no.
Half the time they probably wouldn't answer anyways.
Yeah, I'm thinking by, you know, 4 years late, since their last update, they're probably not paying attention anymore.
Big fan of no ads on preschool apps. It's just especially not just the ads in general, but it eliminates, it's like an extra tap target for kids when they're, you know, wandering off.
Yeah, we see that a lot in our younger iPads where if you go into Safari is like 100 tabs of like the game developer's YouTube channel, because, you know, they just randomly tap something and it takes you to some advertising site or whatever. So that is nice to have apps that don't require that.
So here's an idea for a future MDM command: close off all Safari tabs on this device.
Yeah, yeah.
Another one, and this isn't always possible depending on the platform, but no login needed. It's like you don't want something that's like a one-off thing that requires them to either A, sign in with, like, make an account, or B, sign in, like, socially. And B, even if it doesn't require it, but, like, constantly harasses them to do it. Like, hey, sign into your Twitter account to get extra things, or if it's a game type thing.
Yeah. Particularly if you're looking at an app that might be attractive to, like, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds, trying to get them to sign in with social media, which they probably don't or shouldn't have, is something that I think is potentially problematic. You know, you may end up encouraging kids to get social media accounts that they wouldn't otherwise have just to get the rewards in your game.
Next thing is it covers core skills. I mean, I think the thing I would add here is determine your goals before looking at apps. Like, what are you wanting to reinforce of your curriculum? Mm-hmm. And it may just be like letters and numbers, and that's fine. You know, obviously, with younger kids, that you know, you're not going to have a ton. But just, you know, figure out what you want first.
Yeah, just look for, you know, what kind of skills you're trying to build. We have some apps which we'll mention later on where we use them for just developing motor control. You know, in like 4 and 5 year olds, just a little app that lets them, you know, trace with their finger on the screen and it draws a line behind them. It's called Chalkboard, for example. And just use that for practicing initial letter shapes, getting the shape right, knowing what the shape is. And we use that a lot.
Next one is no in-app purchase, or like there's an EDU edition on the store that has everything unlocked. Obviously, we still can't do in-app purchase through via PPP, so we need EDU editions on the store. If you find something that's great and it's like you look on the store and it's like unlock premium for $2, just avoid that.
Yeah, I had this discussion. We had a chemistry app that our chemistry teacher wanted to put out, and basically what it was like a reference app for the Scottish chemistry curriculum. And I think the problem was that the developer hadn't actually written all the content yet. So what he was doing was he'd put out the app and it had like the initial like one unit in it. And he said, oh, the other units will be in-app purchases. And I had a kind of back and forth thing with him saying, look, you know that like in most schools running an iPad deployment, nobody will be able to buy your in-app purchases. And he's like, all right, okay. And we ended up just not doing anything because he was like, well, how about I send you an enterprise signed bundle and stuff like that? And I was like, no. Just, you know, just finish your app and get it on the store kind of thing.
But, bingo.
You know, he needed to get it out for the start of school term, but the content wasn't finished and so on and so on.
Let's see, what else do we have here? Easy to move between sections. And so I'll give an example of this. Our school uses a program called Lexia. It helps reinforce like reading, comprehension, things like that with our kids. And my son's doing it in kindergarten. And like they were sounding out words, it was saying like strawberry and helping them understand like the words are kind of, it's like two syllables in one. And he had to tap on the picture that was a strawberry. Like it had different things. Well, the cool thing is, like, when he tapped on strawberry, it went to the next one. It wasn't tap and then submit. And there's an argument that I could say that, like, that creates, like, accidental answers because if a kid forgets, he can't go back and change. But it's just, like, I expected it to be the other way, like, tap and then submit. But, like, he was doing it at home, and it's just, like, tap and goes on the next one. And so those are the kind of things to think about. I think there's a lot of things with iOS that take, like, 3 taps when it should be 1 and 4 taps when it should be 2 and – as you know, those are the kind of things you want to think through. And that requires some testing. But you know, if you've got 2 apps in a category you're considering, that's something to look for. What's the last thing? I think this was yours.
Yeah, this was just one that I threw in there. Was that sometimes like too many apps at this kind of stage try and like look like an iOS app, basically. And the thing about iOS at the moment is that, you know, it's very kind of wordy, right? You've got to read the labels and then tap the labels to make the buttons happen. But apps that use both color and shape to identify affordances in the user interface, like home, next, and so on, rather than requiring students to be able to read the text, is it just a really nice nice part of design.
So here's some apps that you know we like, and again, unless I talk about each one of these in depth, you can go and look at them and see if it's something you'd like. And I'll link these in the show notes to outofschool.net. This is episode 193, and so we'll have links to those. These are a couple that we like, that we use here. And I love the Endless series. So there's Endless ABC, yeah. Endless Spanish, Endless 123. And it's not the cheapest app, but gosh, it's really well done. And it's mm-hmm. it's really good for even up to kindergarten age. We actually really like the Spanish one as well. We use that in our Spanish curriculum some. So really, really good mm-hmm. app.
Yeah, George has got Endless 123 on one of the iPads in the house. And she loves it, and I think it's super well done. She doesn't really do the numbers in order, but she does the ones that she likes the best. So she's very familiar with 32, for example. But she's it's quite interesting kind of watching her grow up in a world of really quite sophisticated iPad applications, whereas like my two older children grew up in a world of really quite basic iOS applications at the same age that George is at. And it's been very interesting for me to watch her and watch what she learns about iOS. So, for example, if she's doing something on her mum's phone, she can actually do that little gesture where you swipe away a notification at the top of the screen. She can do that every single time to get it out of the way of the video that she's watching or whatever. So it's very interesting to just observe that. And Endless 123 is a great example of an app, which is, there's so much design work has gone into that app. It's just incredibly engaging for kids. And what you do in that game is you basically... you have to look at individual numbers and they break them up into component numbers and you have to put the sum back together and things like that. And it's all kind of monster themed and George absolutely loves it.
I like the Super White apps. That's a PBS show. Those are pretty mm-hmm. good. Let's see. Monkey's Preschool Lunchbox is good. My three-year-old really loves that. The Daniel Tiger apps are good. That's another PBS show. If you're not in the US, it's like public broadcasting. I guess that's like our version of your BBC.
Okay.
But it's not near as good. And they always won't. And it's like government funded plus donations, where the BBC, I think, like you have to pay a license to watch it on TV. Your model sounds much better.
Yeah, all we have is spy vans going around the country trying to crack your Wi-Fi to find out if you're streaming any of their programs. I mean, it's just fine.
Let's see. You mentioned the chalkboard one earlier yeah. as well. Mm-hmm. I'm going to check that one out.
Chalkboard is just beautifully simple. It's one of the things that I really appreciate about an app for this kind of age group is that you don't try and do too much. And chalkboard is just, you know, like the way, you know, you and I had when we were at that age, Bradley, just it simulates a chalkboard, right? A kid's chalkboard with a wooden frame. And you have basically two colors of chalk, three, I think, white, red, and green or something like that. And you can just tap on one of them and you can draw with your finger on the screen. And that's all it is. And there's a wee eraser you can press to clear the screen, and that's all that app does. But of all the 250 apps in our MDM server, the one that our primary teachers insist is auto-installed on every device they have is that app, because they use it very frequently in the classroom for, you know, coordinating the lesson. You know, it's kind of a teaching technique that has been quite common for a while, where they would give the kids whiteboards and the kids would, you know, draw something on the whiteboard and the whole class would hold it up to show that they had done or understood whatever it was the teacher was talking about. And this is just kind of like a digital version of that. And it's a huge win.
Let's see. Next one, ABC Pocket Phonics. I think that was mine. Mm-hmm. Good app. Again, just simple app. Magnabet. Is that? That's yours.
Yeah, Magnabet is cool. You know, a magnetic alphabet like you put on the chalkboard or on your fridge. This is the digital version of that, right? So in the classroom, the problem with magnetic alphabet is A, you don't have the right number of letters for the letter distribution in the names of children in your class, or you've lost all the A's or something like that. But Magnabet lets children assemble words and phrases on the iPad, but obviously you never run out of and you never lose any letters, so it is constantly, you know, able to do whatever it is the kids want to do. It's a really cool app.
Let's see. Next, Math Bingo. Another. I think we use that one as well because I think you put that on there. But that's a really good app.
Yeah, Math Bingo is basically what you do is you solve little mathematical problems like addition, subtraction, multiplication, division on a bingo board. And if you get five in a row in any direction, you get what's called a bingo bug, right? And a bingo bug is like a little character that you can use to play a bonus game with. And the more bingo bugs you get, the more chance you have to get the bonus levels and so on are the highest score in the bonus round. So that game has been like a huge hit in our school and kids have loved it for years and it continues to be really, really popular.
Let's see. Shape Builder, that was yours, wasn't it?
Yeah, Shape Builder is one that's it's become popular right down at the very earliest stages of the school, where kids are basically encouraged to learn the shapes, you know, square or circle and so on. And it's just a kind of very engaging, interactive game for doing that kind of thing.
And I second this one. You listed this one. Everything from Tokaboka. Definitely agree with that.
Literally everything. There's nothing they've done that hasn't been just outstanding. And if you haven't seen Tokaboka apps, they're not exactly games, right? This is what's so interesting about them. And their very earliest one was called Toka Tea Party. And what I loved about that game, and to be honest, they haven't quite kept this going in the same way as before, but Toka Tea Party basically turns the iPad into a flat tea table, and you can have three or four kids sit around the iPad and they can play like a kind of, you know, serving the tea sort of game with each other over the iPad. And that's what I really liked about that app. The later apps have been a wee bit more kind of, I'm doing this for myself rather than I'm playing with other children using the iPad. But even so, all of the apps, you know, they've got apps called things like Toka House, Toka Store, Toka Robot Lab is great fun. Toka Doctor, Toka Hairdresser is absolutely hilarious as well. So there's a lot of great apps, and kids from about 4 years old up to maybe 7 or 8 really can enjoy those apps.
YouTube Kids obviously is another good one. We love that at home. I mean, there's a lot of, my kids like to watch other kids play with toys like Legos and stuff, but there's a lot of great just kind of fun music videos, teaches learning, like ABCs and numbers and stuff like that. And again, that sounds trivial, but like that helps kids remember that stuff.
Absolutely does. We've deployed YouTube Kids at school this year for the younger age groups. And one of the things that's very interesting is like my middle daughter, Beth, right, she's in primary 5, so she's 9 years old. And she's just starting to make that transition into like more complex and more sophisticated kinds of learning. And one piece of homework that came home that she had to do was she had to write 3 sentences about Lord Nelson, Admiral Nelson, and she had to write 3 sentences about Napoleon Bonaparte. And I was like, well, where are we going to learn this? And Beth doesn't absolutely love reading quite as much as her older sister does. So I thought, well, let's find a video she could watch about those things. And in the YouTube Kids app, which was on her school iPad, we couldn't find anything about either of those topics. So we ended up having to use YouTube through Safari to find educational videos about those two historical characters. Now, there's a lot of stuff that's inaccessible through YouTube Kids, even when you're searching. But it's hard to extrapolate from one anecdote up to the scale of YouTube and say, well, there's nothing educational on YouTube Kids. It's all just entertainment for 3-year-olds. But it was interesting to me just that there was a significant difference between what was available through the web search and what was available through YouTube Kids as well. And it was very much more focused on like entertainment videos rather than informative or educational videos. But it is hard to generalize about an algorithm like that at the scale of YouTube. So it's still a perfectly valid app, and particularly for the stage we're talking about, Bradley, like preschool kids. If you want to give your kids time on YouTube, that is probably a really good way to do it.
And I guess to kind of sum it up, preschoolers need hands-on stuff. We use iPads at centers in preschool, so like they're on them for specific amounts of time. I don't think preschoolers need to be on the iPads for, you know, if your preschool program is 4 hours a day, I don't think they need to be on the iPad for 3 hours of it. And, you know, 3 hours on the iPad, 30 minutes of recess, 30 minutes of lunch. I think it's probably a little excessive. Just all in balance, especially at that age.
Mm-hmm. We don't have preschool in our school as such. We have, you know, what you guys would call kindergarten, primary one. But even George's nursery that she goes to, I sort of observe there that they have like a really wheezy old PC in the corner which never seems to get touched, and people much prefer playing in the sandpit. So they don't have any iPads in there at all, actually. It's just the PC, and then George obviously gets iPad time at home, but I think George might actually love the Apple TV more than the iPad.
Yeah, this time of year, the Curious George Halloween episode is making its rounds at our house. It's a good one.
You know, George is so funny. See, like, she can't actually work the Apple TV because she can't do the swiping gesture on the remote control. But she'll make me put it on for her. And then she'll sit down and she'll go, now, you put the remote control down. That's her phrase. You put the remote down and you go away. In case she's scared I'm going to turn it off or something. Yeah, like that. So like, you can't relax until I've put that down.
Put it down and leave the room. Let me Even 3-year-olds need chill time.
Yeah.
She'll be 4 this spring, right?
She will be 4 in February.
That's hard to believe. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it for this week. Again, thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show this week. We'll have links to everything we talked about, and especially these apps, at our show notes at outofschool.net. I'm Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
Okay, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web.
Have a great week.
Okay, so this is Fraser here. I just got off the webinar with Apple, and some of the interesting things to do with Apple Teacher are around about, whereas Apple Distinguished Educator is really a program for people who are well-versed in using Apple technologies in the classroom, well-versed in teaching in the classroom with technology in hand, Apple Teacher is much more for those colleagues that we all have who are very much beginning not just their journey as a teacher using technology, but also particularly with Apple products. It's very much built around Apple products and Apple apps rather than pedagogical content and things like that. So, for example, in both the Mac track and the iPad track, there are two tracks through the whole progress. You're looking at like a keynote lesson, and you're looking at a pages lesson, a numbers lesson, and also GarageBand, iMovie are in there as well. And then there's a couple of kind of meta ones about workflow on iOS or workflow on the Mac and creativity on both platforms and so on. So really where I kind of see this fits in for people who are likely listeners of this podcast is that when colleagues come to you with their beginner questions about, you know, how do I make a keynote on my iPad, you can send them to the Apple Teacher program and have them sign in there and work through the Keynote for iPad badge, for example, and that will give them most of the basics that they need to know in order to be, you know, effective basic users of Keynote on the iPad. And at the end of the whole program, essentially what you get is you get badges for each of these 8 tracks on 2 different platforms, and then if you achieve them all, you get the special Apple Teacher status badge at the end. So that's really where it fits. I think it's not a rebranding or a competitor to Apple Distinguished Educator. It's much more to do with, I suppose, in some ways, taking the load off of ADEs and trying to provide learning resources and materials for beginning teachers and teachers new to the Apple ecosystem and things like that. So personally, I don't know that I will learn very much through it as a kind of, you know, long-time user of Apple products. But I can certainly see it will benefit me in that I can send a group of people, or I can use those materials with a group of people, or I could send individuals to specific tracks or specific components in the track that I think would be useful for them if there's something that they want me to sit down for like 2 hours and show them how to do something. Well, I don't have 2 hours for that on a one-to-one basis these days. So I'm going to have to have some online learning material take the load. But that's basically the idea of Apple Teacher, and it really looks pretty powerful. At the moment, it's US only, of course, which is a little bit problematic for me because I don't live in the US and neither do any of my colleagues. But I believe worldwide rollout is coming, and I look forward to seeing it in the UK as well. Thanks very much, everybody.